you know, we had some instances where we'd have two of them coming up river at us and one of them coming down river next to us. And we're kind of deciding the best place to be on the river. And if you're in the wrong spot, you're surfing these like 8 to 10 foot waves.
You're listening to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. And this is Trail Talk, where we have casual conversations with all kinds of runners. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. Whenever trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where our conversations might go. So there aren't too many topics that are off limits for us. So if you're ready, let's get started. Well, if you're a regular listener to the show, you might recognize the fact that the introduction or the music that came after that first little clip is different. It's this is a reprise best of episode. I'm going all the way back to episode 28, where I had Brian Hoover as my guest. Brian, at that time, it was recorded in 2020. He had done a kayak trip down the entire length of the Mississippi. And I had followed it on Facebook when he was there. He was able to post as he went along. And when he got finished, I thought, this is something I would like to talk to him about. So this is my conversation from the past with Brian Hoover about his kayaking trip down the Mississippi. I hope you enjoy it. Brian is a great guy. In fact, I think he has been on the podcast several times. I've had him back as a guest. This was his second appearance, and it has been quite a while. Episode 28, we've had a lot of episodes since then. So you might, the way that I do the podcast and some of the things that you hear might not be the same kind of quality, because I hope I am a better podcaster now than I was then when I talked to him. But this is one that I remember was a fun episode to listen to, as well as for me to do. So I'm bringing it back as a best of episode. Hope you enjoy it. Here is my conversation with Brian Hoover. My guest today is Brian Hoover, and it's Brian. You have the honor of being the first person to have a return.
Uh-oh.
Back is
on now.
being a returning guest on this show. For those of you who may not know who Brian is, I'll let him talk a little bit about who he is. But he is an ultra marathon runner and has hiked the Pacific Coast Trail. So last time you were here, we talked about your hiking of the Pacific Coast Trail, and the fact that you have taken on the van life. And it's sold your stuff, and your home is now your van. So, anyway, you were planning an adventure when we talked last of kayaking the entire Mississippi. So you've gotten that done. So that's kind of what our conversation is going to be about here. But give us a little bit of summary for those of you who didn't see you on last time, kind of who you are, your history about running, and just give a very short introduction about who you are.
Yeah, you bet. Like I say, my name is Brian Hoover. I'm 53. I got into the running world, did all the ultra marathons, did a bunch of marathons, all that. Then kind of transitioned into being a race organizer and chip timer. So that's still my job. I'm really more of a chip timer now than a race organizer. But I've got a wonderful team of people working for me, including a fantastic office manager, Pauline Marks. Shout out. She's basically running my company for me. I still chip in and do stuff, but she's basically running the company for me for the last 3 or 4 years. So I've had all this time on my hands, and I just decided to start playing. You know, I did the old cliche thing now. Sell the house, sell all furniture, sell everything except for my timing business, and bought a van. Been traveling in the van off and on for the last 3 years. Like you said, I did the Pacific Crest Trail last year from Mexico to Canada. And that was so much fun. I wanted to do another big adventure and decided this year to kayak the entire Mississippi River from northern Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico.
So, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, and if I remember right from reading your post, you said that how long did you have experience in a kayak before you started this?
almost none. So I've actually, I think three times in the last 3 or 4 years, I've just been at some touristy spot, you know, where you rent a kayak for an hour, you know, paid the $25, whatever. So I'd say I'd had about 3 hours worth of kayaking experience before I decided to tackle the Mississippi River. So
and
learned as I went.
Yeah. And for, I mean, it's been a long time since I've, my history classes. How long is the Mississippi River?
You know, it depends. It changes every year. The little monument where we started off, we started at, it said 2,550, but it's not. It's about 2,300 miles right now, which could change, you know, but that river's constantly changed, but 2,300 miles.
2,300 miles. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was the kind of, what made you decide that this would be one of your adventures that you wanted to do?
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, I just enjoyed the Pacific Crest Trail so much last year. You know, I love exploring. I love doing something new. I love testing myself. You know, seeing nature. And I just kind of thought, you know, I'm also one of those people, you know, a lot of racers, a lot of ultra runners or marathoners, you know, they'll do the same race year in, year out because they like it, has a special place in their heart. But, you know, I'm always looking for something different. You know, if someone had asked, will I ever do the Pacific Crest Trail again? Probably not, just because I've done it. So I wanted some other kind of adventure that I could see the country. And I think I stumbled across some Facebook post or something of some guy that had just finished it the year previously. And I thought, wow, that would be amazing. So, you know, no big interesting story. I just, you know, thought it would be similar. And I saw something about it. And I, you know, I thought, why not?
So is it kind of a thing like the Pacific Crest Trail and
yeah,
others? I mean, is that like a community of people who take this on and do this? Yeah.
So I guess the real answer would be no. You know, there's like 5,000-6,000 people every year that do the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail. There's one Facebook group called Mississippi River Paddlers. And they do keep a little spreadsheet of everyone that's attempting it and has finished it. And I think there was like 60 people that signed up, or not signed up, but had made their intentions known that they planned on doing. And I think about 15 of those 60 actually finished. So it's not really a thing. I mean, it kind of is, but it's a very small thing. They actually say more people attempt Everest than attempt to do the Mississippi River.
Wow.
No, and I'm not comparing the difficulty at all, but you know, it's a thing, but it's a very small.
It's a very small group. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's interesting. So, but you ran into, I remember you said you ran into people along the river they seem to be used to having, you know, used to meeting people like you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll back up. Well, let me just say that there are people that follow this little Facebook group. I don't know how many people's in this group, probably 400 or 500 people. But if you post to that group and kind of let the community that lives along the river know where you're at, you know, they kind of keep up and they watch out for you. And while we're paddling, I can't tell you how many, literally probably 100 messages, you know, on Facebook and on that group saying, hey, we live, you know, a mile from the river and near this town. When you get here, give us a call. And, you know, we would. And probably, I think we were on the river for 111 days. And I bet you 20, 25 of those days, we were staying the night. People would invite us to their house. They'd cook us dinner. They'd cook us breakfast the next morning. They'd let us use their washer dryer. Some would even let us use their vehicle to go into town to resupply. So it's an amazing group of people that live along the Mississippi River that just 100% go out of their way to do anything that we need. We're kind of minor celebrities because there's so few of us that do this.
Mm-hmm.
They really enjoy hearing our stories, the camaraderie. So it's incredible, and it makes the journey so much easier. And you know, I've met some of the greatest people in my life doing this adventure. So
yeah, and I imagine you on the trail. Remember, you talked about meeting other people who are also traveling,
right?
But these are people who are actually residents, and
yeah. And on the trail, there's 4,000 or 5,000 people that do it. So even these, they're called trail angels on the trail and river angels on the river. But these trail angels on the trail, you know, they've got 40, 50 people coming into their house every day. You know, they can't give out the attention and the care that they can to when there's one paddler might come by once every 2 weeks, rather than 30 or 40 stopping by their house every day. So, it's just incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So, what was it like, you know, for your day to day? What were your expectations
my expectations were not, I didn't have that many. There's not a lot on the internet. There's one guy that did a video series, and I watched his video series for his own entire trip. So I had a little bit of knowledge, but there's not a lot of resources. So, I went in with kind of a complete open mind. Like I said, I didn't have any kayaking experience. I didn't know all the dangers of the river. But let me just kind of explain. There's really four different kind of parts of the river, and they're all very distinct. The first stretch from northern Minnesota to Minneapolis, the river, when we started off, the river was only like, I don't know, 10 feet wide. And maybe 8 inches deep. And so a lot of that, we're like pushing ourselves off the bottom of the river because we bottom out. We're dodging tree limb. You know, one tree falls completely over the river and you're kind of ducking under it. And there are dams from the beginning all the way to Minneapolis, but there's no locks. I don't know if you know what a lock is, but it's kind of like an elevator that lowers your boats down. So we'd have to put our kayaks on these little wheeled carts and wheel around these dams. The longest one was about a mile and a half that we had to literally, you know, pull our kayaks on these wheels.
Okay.
And then you get into south of Minneapolis, you start getting the barge traffic.
Okay.
The water gets deeper, the river gets wider, and you get these massive, massive barges that have put out these humongous wakes. But there the dams have the locks. So we would go through the locks. And then from St. Louis on down, there's no dams. It's just a free-flowing river, but the current gets a lot stronger. So it's very different in each stage of the river, and it evolves very slowly from one type of, you know, at the beginning, like I said, we were getting stuck and pushing ourselves. And then later, you know, it's 40, 50 foot deep and you've got different dangers and obstacles that you're dealing with. So,
yeah. So, and I guess, you know, I've always seen the Mississippi River down farther south, you know, St. Louis area, right. Or maybe a little bit farther north, is where I've always seen it. So dams on the Mississippi River was not something that even would come to mind. So,
yeah.
So do they make lakes? Do they have the dams to make lakes, or is it just for flood control?
I'm guessing flood control mostly, Minneapolis, Minnesota. We did go through some very big lakes. There was this one lake when you're out in the middle of it, which we didn't venture out in the middle of it. It's kind of dangerous to do that. But if you were in the middle of it, you'd have 6 miles to go to land anywhere. So, there's big lakes. The currents get very strong. You get like in the St. Louis area, we were starting to get whirlpools, these boils that come up. It just looks like someone's boiling water in the water. The water gets really crazy in that river, especially when that current is moving.
So will the whirlpools actually catch you and turn you and spin you around?
Yeah, they'd completely spin you around. And I've got, you know, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'2". I'm like 250 pounds. So I'm not some skinny, super in shape guy, but My kayak's a little bit unstable to start with. So the faster your kayak is, usually the more unstable it is. So yeah, I'd hit some of those whirlpools and I'd just be going straight. And all of a sudden I'm going like that. It, you know, it almost tips you out of the kayak. So,
wow.
Yeah. And the thing that a lot of people don't realize too, is that we're doing, most of us are doing these in these sit-in kayaks. So we're completely enclosed. Our legs are enclosed. We've got this itty bitty little cockpit. So if you fall out of this kayak, you can't get back in unless you've got help. Someone's holding your kayak. So, you know, if you're a mile from the closest shore and you're by yourself and you tip over, you know, you're swimming half you're swimming. Mile, three quarters right. to get to shore and hoping some barge isn't going to come run you over. So it's, that's our biggest fear is tipping over.
Yeah.
It's not yeah. like we can just hop right back into it. We really can't.
Yeah, I've seen the kayaks. You know, I've been on, you know, smaller rivers, never the Mississippi, but I with yes. a canoe.
Okay.
And so a canoe, I was always able. I mean, I never did it in the river, but in a lake, I could jump out of the canoe. I could climb back
sure.
in.
And yeah, like, and I was always jealous of you canoers, especially because you can carry ice chests and lots of gear. And
yeah, so, yeah. But a canoe is hard to run by yourself.
I guess I've never canoed in my life, so I can't. I've heard that though. Yeah.
Yeah. You really need almost you have two people.
Because one person's basically steering in the back, right?
Yes. Yeah. The person in the back.
Rudder.
Yeah. The steering all comes from the back.
Sure.
And so, but if you're, and you have to sit in the back to steer, and if you don't have anybody with you, the front end comes up and
right.
it's subject to wind yeah. and
right.
it's hard to control.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But,
yeah, yeah, we had I really loved it. Like I said, I'd never been in a sit-in kayak. I've only been in the smaller little rental ones. And I had these little foot pedals that, you know, if I push the left pedal, my rudder makes me go to the left. If I push the right pedal, it makes me go to the right.
Okay.
And it keeps it straighter rather than paddling and kind of doing this back and forth, you know, with that rudder.
Uh-huh.
Would stay in a straight line, so.
Yeah, I've seen those that were that way. I didn't realize, you know, I didn't realize that was how much your paddling would throw you off.
And, yeah, no, pretty much straight as an arrow, no matter what side. You know, I could paddle on the left side all the time if I wanted to and still go straight. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what kind of gear did you carry? What was the did you have to do to prepare for that?
You know, and that's one thing I did have an advantage on because I've done long distance backpacking hikes. I know how to pack light, and I pretty much had a pretty good idea of what I would need as far as tents and sleeping bags. So, you know, if you've ever done, or if any of the viewers have ever done, you know, like an overnight hiking trip, basically that's what I carried: sleeping bag, tent, blow up mattress, you know, clothes, a food bag, small little first aid kit. Of course I had an extra paddle because you don't want to be up the river without a paddle. and I did break a paddle, so thank goodness I did have a spare paddle. Paddle, life jacket, whistle. I did carry a VHF radio, so that's one thing I'd never used before, but we could communicate with the barges. A lot of times, you know, you kind of want to know where they're going so you can get out of their way.
Uh-huh.
So we could get on the radio and say, you know, hey, I'm a southbound kayaker. I'm river descending left. That means if we're going downriver, we're on the left bank, and, you know, kind of say, hey, where do you want me or where are you heading? And they could kind of say, yeah, stay over there. You're fine. Just like I said, I almost emptied out my hiking kit and transferred it to the kayak. So
really
not much specialized stuff except for, you know, an extra paddle, life jacket, VHF radio, that kind of thing. So
okay.
Sponge. Yeah. Yeah.
So the barges, you know, how far? They didn't go close to the shore, I would imagine, but
They would. They want the outer turns of the river because the outer turns are where the current is a little bit stronger. You know, they want to get their speed. There are, they do have channels, so they'd have like red markers red buoys and green buoys. So you okay. knew where the channel was most of the time. And most of the time, as long as you're out of the channel, you're okay. But, you know, we had some instances where we'd have two of them coming upriver at us and one of them coming downriver next to us. And we're kind of deciding the best place to be on the river. And if you're in the wrong spot, you're surfing these like 8 to 10 foot, 10 foot waves, and it can get a little scary. So, yeah.
Wow. So you'd have like three of them passing, of them like side by side on the river.
Yeah. And the worst part was from Baton Rouge to New Orleans. I mean, at that time we'd have, you know, we might have six different barges going different ways between us, but of course the river's pretty wide there. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they're not that close to you. Yeah. And then the other thing is once you hit Baton Rouge, from Baton Rouge all the way to the Gulf, you've got the big, massive ocean-going ships, you know, that go to China, that have the containers mm-hmm. that are stacked, you know, eight high of these, you know, like 18-wheeler containers on them. And those things can be pretty intimidating as well.
Yeah, it sounds like that. And I would imagine sitting just a few inches off the water and seeing those things. So did they like watch out for you? Or I mean,
they did. As a matter of fact, what was really cool about having the radio is we could hear I'd say 95% of the big ships and the barges. They would let the other ships in the area know, you know, hey, we've got two kayakers. They're hugging the left-hand side. Just watch out for them. So, yeah, you know, mm-hmm. that's the last thing they want to do is injure someone and go through whatever paperwork they have to go through and all that. So, yeah, they really did a great job of letting the other boats in the vicinity know where we were. Yeah. And sometimes it was nice because let me backtrack a little bit. I paddled with two other people basically the entire way. And a lot of times you'd hear on the radio, they'd say, hey, we've got a kayaker up here. And they're talking about your buddy. So you kind of know how far ahead or how far back our paddling companions were.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So, but yeah, I started with this married couple. And the husband knew he was going to get off early because he had to go to a job. Mm-hmm. And his wife decided to get off the river for a couple of different reasons. But the very first day we met up with an 81-year-old guy named Stan Stark. And I paddled with him the whole way down. He's going to end up getting the Guinness Book of World Record for the oldest person to ever kayak the Mississippi River. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. So, and also with a 37-year-old guy named Chase. So those were my two companions the whole way.
So they stayed with you the entire time.
They did. Yeah. You know, sometimes we'd, end up camping a mile or two apart from each other, but we were always really close to each other.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what was camping like? I mean, what was that like on the river? I mean, sure, it was be different than trail camping.
Yeah, a little, yeah, definitely. Once again, that there's really two types of environment for camping. For most of Minnesota, it was swampland, basically. It's just all wild rice and cattails growing up. So you've got the skinny little river up there, but for a lot of it, there's no land on either side. So it would be impossible to camp. You'd be sleeping in water. There's no solid land. So we'd have to be really careful and plan out our camp spots. We had some pretty good maps during Minnesota that would show like where little landings were and solid ground. Mm-hmm. And that was more of a woodsy camping. But then as we exited Minnesota, we started seeing all these sandbars, basically these beaches, beautiful white sand beaches just all over the place. Some of the beaches were islands. Some of them were just riverbanks, you know, pristine, no footprints except for animal prints. So I would say for the last two and a half months, we were sleeping on white sand beaches, just like you see in, you know, LA uh-huh. and the coast. So sand became our friend and our enemy.
So what that was like after Minnesota, before Missouri?
Pretty much after Minnesota. I can't remember exactly where we started seeing these. We call them sandbars.
But sandbars, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the whole river bottom is sand. The sides are sand. And they dredge. You know, they're constantly dredging out the channel. I think the channel has to be 9 feet deep all the time. And that sand shifts all over mm-hmm. the bottom. So they've got this machinery that just pumps the sand out onto the banks. So there's literally miles of sandy beaches. So that's almost our exclusive... when we weren't staying in a River Angel's house.
Okay.
When we were in a town, sometimes we'd splurge and get in a motel or a hotel room and, you know, live the high life. So, but.
So I'd imagine a civilization, you know, like a places where you could walk to some place to get, you know.
Yeah.
To find some sort of civilization.
And that was interesting to the river. Too. From the headwaters basically to, well, the first part was pretty marshy and there wasn't much civilization, but from basically about the end of Minnesota till we got to St. Louis, we were paddling up to these bar and grills, you know, with these big wooden patios on the side, mm-hmm. drinking beer.
Right on, you mean right on the river?
Right on the river, eating cheeseburgers. Wow. You know, it's a lot of recreational boat traffic, a lot of marinas, mm-hmm. a lot of riverside restaurants that literally hung out over the river. But like I said, the dams end at St. Louis basically. Mm-hmm. So from St. Louis down, you can't really have civilization on the river because there's no way to, you know, when the river's high, you know, all that stuff's going to be underwater.
Right.
So everything south of St. Louis basically usually was hidden behind some levee wall. You couldn't even see the towns. You'd have to walk a couple of miles.
Mm-hmm.
So it got kind of lonely.
Yeah. But I'd imagine at St. Louis, were the sandbars still there from St. Louis down?
Or yeah, they were. They got a little bit scarce once we got into southern Louisiana.
Okay.
But yeah, we still usually managed to find a sandbar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes we'd be tired, we'd be ready to stop, but we'd have to paddle another hour till we found a nice beach.
Someplace to go.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So the sandbars are fun with the Kansas River, which is where I live in Kansas City. The Kansas River comes right through and that's kind of the river I know. And there's sandbars.
Yeah. You know, I'd imagine just I'd imagine it's probably the same kind of thing. Yeah.
And it's deep enough that there's a channel and the sandbars move around from time, sure. From time to time. There's islands and
sure.
And then, you know, then the river gets high enough, then all those trees wash away. And
right. And we got really lucky because it was a low water year. So there was a lot of sandbars that like last year were not there. Last year was a very high water year. Everything was flooded last year. So
mm-hmm.
we got kind of lucky on that aspect. And the current wasn't as extremely bad, but the current's a good thing because it makes you go faster. Mm-hmm. But it gets a little scary when it's really moving. So
yeah, especially with all the turbulence that can come along with it.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I'd imagine, and if you're out in the middle of the river, was it still as turbulent with boils and whirlpools?
Yeah, we would always try to find because a lot of times we're dodging the wind too. So you know, when that river's really wide, that wind can cause what's called fetch, you know. Small waves turn into bigger waves. The further that wave travels, it kind of gains. So in a perfect world, we would stay right in the middle of the channel where the water's moving the fastest. But like I said, a lot of times we were in the slower water on purpose because the slower water was less, you know, we'd have a little protection from the wind and the waves mm-hmm. weren't as bad. So you could ask 10 different people the best way to, or where they should be paddling at any one given time. And everyone's got their own, you know, little strategies to, you know, so, but yeah, we got to be pretty good at deciding where we wanted to be. You know, mm-hmm. we want to be out of traffic. We want to be in the fastest water we can, but at the same time, we're wanting to find the calmer water if it's a rough, windy day. So,
yeah. Well, and there was a big storm that came through the inlet. Derecho was what the official name of it was.
Yeah.
It's an inland hurricane.
Yeah.
And, you were in that. How did that, what was that like?
So I had never even heard of that word before.
Neither had I. I mean, it's all of my life. I was like, this is the first time I've ever heard of this happening.
Right. So that we got one of them, a pretty big one in Minneapolis is the city, Minnesota is the state, in Minnesota. But we knew it was coming, and we got off the river about 5 o'clock, and it hit about 6:30. It was still daylight at the time. And we just we found a good place in a grove of trees that was a little bit protected from the wind.
Mm-hmm.
My tent almost blew away. One of my buddies that was kayaking with us, his tent did blow away. None of us got hurt, but it was pretty intense. Yeah, we were. I was literally in the tent trying to hang on to the tent to keep it from blowing away.
So your buddy's tent that blew away, he wasn't in it then, I take it.
I think he was in it, but then he got out to fix. I think it pulled up one of the stakes, and it kind of blew off into the bushes. You know, it didn't get hurt, but you got very wet.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and if you were in Minnesota, you were more on the edge of it than the hole in the center of it. Yeah. So,
I don't know. There was a few of them. I don't know, but the one that they were talking about was supposed to be pretty intense, but it didn't feel, I think we were on the edge because, mm-hmm. it didn't even topple any trees or anything like that.
Cause
I think I know which one you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, because it was it moved I think 700 miles across the country, and so the center of it was basically what they call it an inland hurricane.
Yeah,
and it's had straight winds of 140 miles an hour.
Yes,
and they
traveled a long way, right? It
traveled a long ways, yeah. And so Iowa. Was kind of where the center of that damage was.
No, we weren't in that one.
Okay.
I did hear about that. Now that I think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but it was, I'm not sure. I knew it was fairly wide as well, but, I think Minnesota would have been on the kind of the,
yeah, no, this was a different time of year. I mean, there's small derechos. They were calling it a derecho, but it wasn't nothing like what hit, Iowa and Wisconsin or wherever it swept
through. Yeah, I think it came through. And I know that it was on the eastern side of Iowa was where my son lives. And so, you know, that's where I'd seen the damage and just huge trees knocked over.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have wanted to be standing,
standing
in a grove of trees with something like
this
that.
This was a baby compared to that one. So,
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you have any other weather that was
difficult? We did. You know, truthfully, I'll first say that we had amazing weather for 95% of the trip, you know, 70 to 80 degrees, it was sunny almost every day. I think we only paddled in the rain 2 or 3 days. The winds weren't too bad, but we did have we had two hurricanes that slowed us down. The first one was Hurricane Delta.
Mm-hmm.
We were way up in Vicksburg, Mississippi. But we still had to take a couple of days off because we're supposed to be 40, 50 mile an hour winds, which is mm-hmm. way too much for my butt to be on the river. And then just a few weeks ago, we had Hurricane Zeta, I believe, that hit New Orleans. And we were in New Orleans at the time. We had planned on taking 3 days off. We were going to leave, I think, on a Sunday morning. And we started hearing the reports of that hurricane coming in. So we stayed like 3 more days in New Orleans.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we weren't out in the river during them, but it definitely slowed us down some.
So we were in New Orleans with kayaks. What was that like?
Yeah.
Were you able to?
Yeah. So Stan, he's 81 years old. He does all these kayak races. Same thing as ultras. You know, it's a tight knit community. You know, some are shorter, you know, 50 mile races, others are 350. So he knows a lot of the kayaking community. So a lot of times, especially the further south, he's from Gulfport, Mississippi.
Okay.
so which isn't too far away. But anyways, long story short, a lot of times he had friends that had kayak trailers and would come pick us up from the river, load our kayaks up on his kayak trailer, store them wherever, and take us to a hotel or a bed and breakfast or something.
Okay. So, yeah. Yeah. Cause I was thinking, you know, 6 days in New Orleans with kayaks, I was like, what would you do? You don't just store that in a hotel room.
Yeah. And just leave, you know, we didn't even really want to leave them, anywhere that they weren't watched, because, you know, that's all it takes is someone to steal your kayak and all your gear and stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we were pretty cautious about leaving our kayaks unattended, which was,
so was it easier farther north? I mean, was it to leave them somewhere, so, or was it
farther north? Most of the time we actually stayed at people's houses that live right on the river.
Okay.
So we would like literally tie them up to their dock. We did have a few people that would do the same thing up north, would have a trailer, mm-hmm. and take their kayaks to wherever we were staying or keep them with them. I a lot of people, actually, I was surprised how many people have trucks or trailers that can, you know, these kayaks are 17, 18 feet. You can't even really get them in the back of a, you know, a good sized pickup truck. So,
right.
Yeah, it was definitely a logistical nightmare a lot of times,
because
people would want to say, hey, we live a mile from the river, you can come stay with us. And like, well, we can't really just leave our kayaks sitting on the riverbank. And so we did have to turn down some offers because of the kayak logistics. So
yeah, and then your other thing is, did you have your wheels with you the whole time? Or
no, we actually sent our wheels home basically after about Minneapolis, because that's the end of the portages where we got to put our kayak wheels on. One of the guys, Chase, the younger kid, he did keep his the whole trip, but Stan and I, we sent ours home because it takes up a lot of room. And but yeah, they would have come in handy in some instances for sure.
Right. Yeah. Because you could walk a mile. could get out and walk a mile
exactly
with a kayak if you
exactly.
I could see that.
Yeah.
So what is the thing that you're going to take away from this? What's kind of your,
you know, the biggest thing is I didn't really realize I was going to like kayaking that much. It's just, it's amazing. You know, we would paddle, you know, 8-10 hours a day, but, and you know, our backs were sore, our shoulders were sore. I had blisters on my hands until I developed calluses. So I'm not saying it wasn't a physical activity, but I'm never, that whole trip, I was never out of breath, never breathing hard. Mm-hmm. You know, even at the end of the day, you know, my butt's sore, my legs are stiff, but I still felt like I could paddle longer. Whereas hiking, at the end of the day, hiking, oh man, my feet are killing me. Every muscle in my body is sore. I just couldn't wait to set the backpack down and be done. But, it was, truthfully, it was probably less physical than what I thought it would be, and very enjoyable. Just the weather, being right there on the water, being able to wash everything all the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was going to enjoy it as much as I did. So
what did you do for water? I mean, you had water there, but I mean, did you purify with river water? I mean, I've seen some of the water in those rivers. I was like, I don't know that I'd even want to drink it if I'd run it through a purifier.
All right. I'll tell you what, Eric, I haven't told many people this, but first off, let me say that 99.99% of the people buy water. Some people will filter it up in Minnesota. You know, you don't have the factories, you don't have the agriculture, you don't have the chemicals going into the river. So even some of my buddies filtered it up in Minnesota. And then you just buy enough water to last you till the next stop. I don't recommend this to anyone. This is absolutely crazy. And I know that I've got an iron stomach, and my buddies made fun of me the whole time. I literally just dipped my bottle down and drank. First, I said, I'm only going to do that till Minneapolis. Then I said, I'm only going to do it to Memphis. Then I'm only going to do it to St. Louis. I ended up doing it the whole way. And knocking on wood, I survived.
So you drank it filtered or no, just straight
out of the.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't. So but like I say, that's idiotic. And I don't think anyone else in the country could do that. Like I said, I've always known I've got a strong stomach, but even so, yeah. There's chemicals. There's
a lot of stuff in there. Yeah.
It's pretty bad water. A lot of people won't even, they say they won't even swim in it past a certain point. Mm-hmm. Bottled water, Stan and Chase, my buddies, we would know kind of how far to the next place that we could get water. I think Chase at one time carried 7 gallons of water. So a lot of heavy weight, taking up a lot of room.
I can see that with the heat. I mean, it would not be hard to drink a gallon a day.
Yeah. And like I said, we got really lucky. I can only think of 4 or 5 days that I'm just sweating. If it was hotter and maybe more like a regular temperature, I think they would have drank a lot more water mm-hmm. than that. But you know, if you run out, then yeah, you can filter it. We all had filters. I didn't use mine. you can boil your water. You're going to burn through a lot of fuel, but mm-hmm. In an emergency, if you ran out of clean water. So
did you find like firewood and have like a campfire every night when you camped?
Yeah, we did. Some of those beaches were just sand, nothing around. So on those nights we wouldn't, but a lot of them had just, more dry wood than, we could have started 28 bonfires. But yeah, we actually did. We did a lot of fires, drank a lot of beer around the campfire.
Yeah.
And it's so nice too. I keep referring back to hiking, but some nights hiking, we wouldn't build a fire because we'd have to walk a mile to get enough water to douse the fire, and you can't leave these fires burning.
Oh, right.
But on the river, you've got nothing but sand and water. We couldn't accidentally start a fire if we tried to. So,
right.
Yeah.
So you were comparing hiking to paddling.
Yeah.
Did your body adapt to the hiking or did you get to the end the same way with your sitting down and getting used to sitting for all that time?
Yeah. And that's interesting. And I'm sure everyone's different. For the hiking, my body, everything in my body adapted except for my feet. My feet were just hamburger every day. And that could have been because I didn't have enough cushioning. I wore some pretty lightweight shoes called Ultra Lone Peaks.
I'm familiar with those.
Yeah. I was going to switch to a pair of Ultras that had a little more cushioning, but I didn't. In the kayaking, my butt adapted, my shoulders adapted, my hands adapted. I got nice calluses all over all the pressure points.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I said this wrong, but my left shoulder never really did. It was kind of always a little bit sore, not painfully sore, but sore throughout mm-hmm. the whole journey. So, and like I said, I hadn't had any paddling experience. My two other buddies, they'd kayaked enough that I think they built up their shoulder muscles enough. They didn't really have the issues that I did. But
well, and it sounds like you had the river was calm enough at the beginning to give you some of that.
Yeah. Yeah. For
sure. It's only 8 inches deep.
Yeah, exactly. through the whole state except for the lakes that we went through, that was a whole different mm-hmm. story. There were huge waves on those lakes, but when it turned back into a river, the river's small enough or narrow enough that even if it's windy, we didn't really even have waves for most of that. Huh. So yeah, it does. It kind of, there's a guy that we met. He said that the river is like school. He said, from the headwaters to Minneapolis, he'd call it middle school. And then from Minneapolis to St. Louis is high school. And then it just keeps getting more difficult from St. Louis to Baton Rouge is college. And then south of Baton Rouge, you get the big, huge container ship thrown in because that's your PhD.
Okay.
So it does kind of work you into the, you can go in as a beginner like I did, mm-hmm. as long as you're not doing anything, crazy. And and slowly get better as you travel down the river. So,
okay. That's yeah. cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
What about wildlife? I mean,
you read my mind. I'd say truthfully, the most beautiful part was the northern part, northern Minnesota. You know, it's rural. There's wetlands. In Minnesota, it wouldn't be uncommon for us to, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, to see 50 to 70 bald eagles every single day.
Wow.
The otters playing. We saw thousands. I mean, literally, sometimes we would see 1,000 white pelicans along the banks. It almost looked like it was a couple times we thought it was snow because they're just so densely packed. It looked like a snowbank. Lots of deer, never saw any bears, never saw no alligators. What we did see, and you may have heard of these, they're called Asian flying carp.
Oh, yes.
And about the St. Louis area is where they really start getting bad. It sounds like you know what they are. They're an invasive species.
They're an invasive species. Yeah.
Yeah, they're garbage fish. But the unique thing about them, the Asian flying fish, they jump.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew we were going to hit those, especially I think they're really attracted to the spin of a propeller.
Right. And the videos I've seen, I've never seen them in person, but the videos I've seen is that there's something about the motor of a, you know, the vibration or whatever that causes them to jump.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So did you,
we are very indoctrinated in the Asian flying carp now. So we hadn't seen one, you know, we were kind of waiting. We were asking all the locals, hey, well, when will we start seeing these flying fish? And we hadn't seen one. And I'm paddling along, and like I say, we hadn't seen one at all. And all of a sudden, boom, right in front of my kayak, one jumps up, and I'm paddling pretty fast. It hits me in the lip, kind of bloodies my lip a little bit, but then it fell down inside my cockpit.
And
And this thing's probably, I don't know, 2 to 2.5, 3 feet long, big fish. He's flopping around down where a guy don't want him flopping around. At, you know what I mean? And, you know, it happened so fast. I almost tipped over, but I got my hands underneath it and scooped it out of my lap and threw it overboard. We didn't see another one for like 5 or 6 days. But then there were a couple of times, like you see in the video. I mean, it's just, you can see 30 or 40 of them, they're banging against the side of your boat. They're hitting our paddles. Just boom, 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 boom. Huh. Crazy.
So even with, they would, was
even
it?
With paddles,
even
yeah,
with the paddles.
Yeah, even with the paddles. I mean, I think it's worse. And obviously a lot more dangerous if you're going 30 miles an hour in a boat and one of those hits you in the face.
Right.
Stories of people losing their eye, getting knocked unconscious. But yeah, even with the paddles, they would just explode the water.
So whatever disturbance vibration, there was in the water.
I'm really not sure exactly what causes them to jump.
Jump right by you.
Definitely do it.
So did they ever jump for like with nothing, or is it always just some sort of disturbance?
Mostly some kind of disturbance. Sometimes we see one jump, you know, quite a ways off. But it's usually within like a 20-yard diameter of where you are. They're just popping behind you. And then they do it for 5-10 seconds, which is a long time, actually. But and then they'd stop and wouldn't see one for the rest of the day. So I don't know. Yeah, but that's an experience. Yeah. I always wish everyone says, you didn't get no video of them? But, you know, it happens so fast. And it's like, dig out your phone, put it in, you know, they're gone. But, yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, I've not seen them in person, but I've seen the videos of those and seen
this. Yeah. I had never seen them in person either, but yeah.
Well, and you said that you had your next adventure planned.
Yeah.
So tell a little bit about what you're thinking about and
Yeah. I mean, so I've hiked a long distance trail and I've kayaked a long distance. And, you know, like I said, I always want to try something new that I haven't done. I am very much not a bicyclist or a mountain biker. As a matter of fact, I really haven't rode a bike regularly since I got my driver's license, I guess, you know, when I was a kid. So, but I'm going to buy a dirt bike and not a dirt bike, a kind of a mountain bike,
A mountain
hybrid
bike.
type bike, and ride from like San Diego, Tijuana area down to Cabo San Lucas, which is the Baja Peninsula. So yeah, I hope to do that. I think that's 1700 miles. The locals are just supposed to be amazing, amazing beaches, cheap everything. But yeah, first of January, I hope to start that little adventure.
Wow.
So
Okay. So
yeah.
how long would that take you?
No, I don't know. Like I said, I'm not a site. So 1700 miles, it is very mountainy, so I think it's going to depend a lot on the terrain, but I think we could do 35 miles a day, 40 miles a day. So I'm hoping under 2 months. So
Okay.
not relatively not that long. So
So, and do you speak Spanish?
I do a little bit. You know, I
A
had
little
a
bit.
little bit in middle school, a little bit in high school. I can pick up a word or two. I mean, but nowadays if there's internet, which I don't know if I'll have any, but you know, there's those apps. I'm still in the early planning stages of it. I don't know the exact route we're going to take. But everyone that I've talked to and that I've read up on said that there's maybe one little area that you want to make sure you're not riding at night. But they said that's still not worse than going through like a downtown city in America. And I've got a couple of friends that I'm going to be doing it with. I won't be doing it alone.
Okay, that should
Yeah.
help. I'd always have heard, you know, especially of Tijuana, or yeah,
Tijuana is one of those places.
is one of the places, yeah,
Probably one of the worst places.
that always I'd always heard that that was not some place to
Right.
be hanging
Right.
out.
Exactly. And we may start. I don't know if we'll actually start in Tijuana. We might be in a city near Tijuana, but I think any of those border towns can get a little dicey. So we'll definitely start that during the daytime. And I don't think it's going to be, from what I've heard, the locals are just even more friendly than your average American. You know, they're just so interested in what we're going to be doing. And so hopefully we don't run into any problems.
So is there like a community that is like the similar to the river community that you
That's
can get
another good
information
question.
about?
There must be a little bit because there's a lot of blogs on it. There might be more info on this trip than there is the Mississippi river paddle, but I don't know as far as like a community of locals that kind of will invite us into their houses. Hopefully there will be. I'm in the very beginning stages of researching this, so I'm still a little ignorant on the ins and outs of what I'll be facing. So,
And you had a family, your grandchild born while you were on the river, didn't you?
I did, yeah, and that was hard to be on the river. And I actually got off the river for a few days and took an Amtrak train and met him briefly for a day or two, and then hopped right back on the river. So, I mean, that's what's just so hard about these adventures. You're gone for so long, and you miss, especially when you've got young kids or young grandchildren, where they're changing all the time. So, you know, that's a big sacrifice that I'm making, and not being around my grandchildren as much as I could be. So.
So, but you're back home now for a little
I
bit
am, yeah, and I'm getting some good. Well, as a matter of fact, I'm going to get a COVID test again to make sure I didn't pick up anything. And then tomorrow, if the results come back, I'll visit with my daughter and her granddaughter, and then go up to my son's house. So yeah, and you definitely get some family time in.
Just from the travels that you were on, that you thought you might have encountered COVID, is that the
I don't know, but with young babies, I don't want to even take any chances. You know, we were around people. You know, we weren't totally isolated. We'd go into town every 3 or 4 days. We'd eat at restaurants. Like I said, we were in not 100, but 30 or 40 local families' homes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we wore a mask when we could, but you know how it is. There's times that we didn't. So you never know. And like I say, my family, I don't think be so concerned except for having small young children in the house.
Young kids, I could see that.
So. Yeah.
So. Well, hope that COVID test turns out negative.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. We'll be safe.
Yeah. Most of the time, from what I've heard, if you don't have symptoms, it's pretty much.
Right. Yeah. And I don't. So, and, I'm too ugly to get it. No.
Well, I think part of it is also just a mindset of, you know, we tend to, people who are active tend to be healthy. And
I think so. You know, but I'm not and like I say, that's kind of what I try to tell my friends and my family or anyone that wants to do some adventure is, you know, I'm an overweight guy. I started the river out at 250 pounds. I did lose some weight doing it. And the same thing for the hiking is, you know, don't wait till you're completely in great shape if you ever want to do one of these big adventures. Or don't wait till your finances are absolutely perfect, because, you know, sometimes that may never happen. A lot of these things that I do, you know, you actually get in shape while you're doing it. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not a race where you've got to go into it, you know, in top peak physical condition. I stayed up with everyone during my Pacific Crest Trail hike that I wanted to stay up with. And the same thing on the river. So, you know, you don't have to be some extreme ultra athlete to do some of the stuff that I'm doing.
Yeah. 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 And I know that you've kind of arranged your life so that you can do some of these adventures.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm taking advantage of it. You know, I might not be able to do it in a couple of years. My health might go down, or financial stuff, or family stuff. So I'm packing it in while I can. Yeah.
Well, and it's that we tend to put off those types of things. There's always, I know that there's a lot of things for myself that I let life get in the way, and things that I could have done used life situations as an excuse to say, oh, I'll do it later.
Right. And, so a buddy of mine said, I don't remember the exact quote, but he said, life's kind of built backwards or upside down. You know, you wait till you're 65 till you retire, whatever age. And a lot of times, you know, you're too old. You can't walk around that good. You can't do a lot of the things that you wanted to do. Whereas when you're younger, you know, you're almost programmed to not do those kind of things. You know, of course, you're raising a family, you're building your career and a lot of that. But so many people just wait too long to, you know, follow their dreams. And then when they've got the time and the money to do it, you know, a lot of times their body's, you know, letting them down. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people that I went to high school with. I mean, they're running into health problems, and but then I look at like your partner that
81 years old.
Yes,
exactly. He's the exception other than the rule. And, you know, you're in great shape, but, you know, a lot of people aren't, you know, a lot of people don't, you know, when they get that age, their knees are failing, or their back's going out, or they've got some kind of debilitating thing going on. So,
And that's one of the things I've been telling people, is to take care of your body. My neighbor, I got him a balance pole, cause he's been, he's trying to get in shape. And, he says, hey man, take care of your feet. You know, walking on this balance pole will help get your feet in shape and your knees and your hips and loosen that up. And so, that's one of the things and I stretch every morning. I stretch. Sure. Just the importance of taking care of my body
I mean, like I say, you're in great shape. You said you're doing
Bandera is 100K.
And that's the only distance still. I knew it used to be just 100K.
I think there's a 50K option. If I remember right, but I was interested in the 100K, just because, and it is a difficult course, they give, I think, a 24 hour cutoff, which is, you know, that's a pretty generous cutoff. Sure, which usually, yeah. if you've got a high, you know, if you've got a generous cutoff, that means
there's a reason for it.
Right.
Yeah. It's called Hill Country for a reason. And what are those cactuses? The Sotal cactus? I haven't run that course, but I always hear about the Sotal cactus.
Yeah, there's cactus that I've had some people who've run it. They say it's almost, if you get close to it, it's like a proximity detector.
Yeah.
If you get close to it, the barbs of the cactus will actually come off and come at you.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of people's legs almost look like briars. I mean, and they've told me that a lot of times you don't feel it while you're running, but then you're like, man, why is my leg stinging? You get all these scrapes all over. So.
Yeah.
I have not run that course.
I was, we'd had some vacation in the Hill Country, a little bit north of there, of the race. Yeah. And so, I've been on some trails that are, you know, similar terrain, but I know it's very, very rocky and, you know, there's a lot of hills and, so it'd be a lot of power hiking. I know.
So I'm
looking forward to that. A lot of my races that I wanted to do this year got canceled.
Right.
So I have a deferment from the Hawk 100. I had signed up for that and then it got canceled. So I'm deferred for that for next year.
Okay.
I'll make up for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I know a guy, Troy Pruitt is, thinking about running the Outlaw 100.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I may travel down and have a, if he needs a pacer, I might go down and.
Yeah. I may see if you're down there. I do hope to get to that one and work an aid station or something.
Oh
like that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's another one that's, it's got a high cutoff for a 100 mile race because it's a pretty, pretty tough course.
Pretty gnarly. Yeah. 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 For sure.
But I feel blessed to be able to keep going, keep moving. And, you know, my dad's 83 and he's still working on cars. So,
oh really? Yeah. That's what it takes. You know, it's just, even if it's something to look forward to, you know, you got something you're training for, something that you're looking forward to, you know, and I'm sure you've noticed too, a lot of these events, especially like the ultras and stuff, it's, I think almost more of a social event. You know, you start seeing the same people and you recognize them and, you know, you're hanging out before the race, you're hanging out after the race. And, you know, the same kind of thing on some of the stuff I do, it's, you know, it's the people that you meet that create the longest lasting memories, sometimes. So.
Yeah. And that has been an aspect that, of running that trail running that I have found is the community of people to encourage you. And, you know, you're finding that on the trail and in your adventures. Is that it is the people that you meet and the people you get to hang out with. And
I always had told people, you know, these marathons, you know, like New York or Chicago, when there's 20, say if there's 20,000 people, you know, you might meet 10 people, but if there's 200 people, you're going to meet 25 of them. You know, it's kind of weird how a smaller event, I don't know. It seems like you just meet more people, you remember more people, and it's just more social. So
And that's that kind of the encouragement that you get from other people is
For sure.
And so, and for a lot of people who don't have activities like that, I mean, we tend to be isolated, and especially this year all been even more isolated.
Yeah.
And I've been able to plug into a lot of people in the last 5 years that have really been, it was like, it's added a lot of richness to my life, just because of that and the trail running community. So,
before you know it, all your friends are runners or all your friends are whatever kind of thing you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of encouragement. So,
Well,
hey, thank you a lot, Brian. I appreciate that. And I will hope that you have a little bit of internet connection for your bicycle adventure. Cause that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think if anything, I can go into like an internet cafe when I'm in a town and kind of do some updates and stuff. So you'll be hearing from me.
Yeah. See, and again, you know, I've got preconceived notions about the Baja is that it's all desert and nothing but small towns and it's just all wilderness, kind of like the Mississippi, of thinking like, oh, is there anybody who lives on the Mississippi? And,
right.
And you found people who had the restaurant hanging off the riverbank.
Yeah.
And So I will look forward to seeing your adventures and the pictures of what you find at Baja. So.
Well, and I appreciate you inviting me back on. You know, I thought after that first one, you'd unfriend me and send me hate mail. And
Well, no, the problem was all on my end. It wasn't.
I'm not saying anything about the technical stuff. Oh. I'm just saying. Oh.
It was great. I enjoyed hearing about your adventures and look forward to meeting you in person sometime.
Yeah, so. For sure. I'll see you at some race before long.
Yeah, once we start racing, getting races again.
Get scheduled back going. Yeah.
Yeah. So sure. Thanks again, Brian. And I'll be seeing you on Facebook.
Okay. Thank you much.
Yeah.
All right. Take care, man.
Bye. Bye. Hey, thanks for watching, listening to this episode of Trail Talk. If you saw this on live by my friend Brian, I really appreciate his outlook on life and the fact that he is going for the kinds of adventures that he wants to go after. And so that mindset of being able to pursue the richness of life, that's what I'm about here, the ultramarathon mindset. That's kind of what I want to help other people achieve, whatever goal it is, whatever dream you have, whatever you want to pursue. It's your mindset of being able to decide, or of saying what you want to do, having that mindset of going after it and not putting things off, not being afraid to go after the adventures that you want in life. Don't put it off till later, do it now. If you want to contact me, if you want to get in touch with me, message me on Facebook I'm at the Ultramarathon Mindset on Facebook. TheUltramarathonMindset.com is my website, so you can touch base with me there if I can help you. Thanks for watching this, listening to this on if you're listening to this on podcast. Appreciate it, and I'll see you next time.